I'm Monica Taylor, and today I'm delighted to be having a conversation with my old friend and colleague, who is now Professor Emeritus in Educational Psychology at the University of Alabama, from where he retired in 2019, Professor Steve Toma. Steve,
Yes.
I was thinking about when we first met. And this is going to be a story against myself.
Okay.
And you must say if you think I'm right or wrong about this.
Okay.
I think when I first became aware of you and met you was over a dinner table at AME in 1986, when you got the dissertation award as a young scholar. And I was sitting there with Dwight Boyd. I believe this was in Chicago. Have I got that right?
That's right.
And Dwight and I had met the previous year when he organized AME in Toronto. And I think we were being a bit naughty and laughing quite a lot. And I think, if I remember rightly, you were sat between Jim Rest and Larry Kohlberg
Same table, I think, yeah.
at the same table. And I think Larry nearly fell off his seat. And that
It
was
would,
why we
yeah.
were laughing. So I don't mean to be disrespectful to Larry, but that's my memory of first being aware of in the same space as you.
But my story is a wee bit different. I don't recall him s falling off his seat, but I remember that in the awards presentation, he went up and gave a really sweet review of my work and how much he was interested in it. And I was much taken by that. And then as he was walking off the stage, he almost fell.
Perhaps
I
that's
think
where he
he,
was. Yes.
yeah, I think he did fall, and people were, there was this hush, and then people started twittering around. I heard that, but for me it was great because I was a nervous wreck. I mean, this sounds awful, but then I knew that when I went up to say what I had to say, no one would care what the heck I said because they were still sort of processing what they had just seen.
So it diffused the situation a bit.
Yes.
I
But that
think
was that, yeah, that was something.
you could be right, or there might have been an element of a pre-fall at the
Yeah,
table.
it
So
could be.
yeah. So yes, it was a little bit dramatic. But unlike that beginning, our relationship went on to be very serious much later when you were on the JME board. We'll come to that, I'm sure, in more detail. And you were chair of the board for my final years as editor. So we actually worked very closely together, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that later.
And on the AME board as
And
well.
indeed on the
Yeah.
AME board, which funnily enough, I had to remind myself of today because I've graded this. How could I have forgotten that we were on
Never.
the AME board forever,
Right.
like, and
Yes.
that when I was president, you were treasurer. Now,
That's
it
right.
just shows you what selective memory one has, right? So we want to establish early on in this conversation that actually we did have a very serious set of relationships during which we gradually got to know one another and how we function. And then we became more personally friendly. And I remember a wonderful time post AME, which I think was in St. Louis, and you drove me back home with you via Memphis to Tuscaloosa, where I
That's
stayed
right.
with you. and Amy, your wife.
Right.
I went down to St. Louis by train and ended my visit with you by going north to Washington, D.C. by train.
That's
And
right.
then you came to stay with me here in England later on when you were associated more with Birmingham. Not that I
Right,
lived here then.
and before that too,
Before
with
that.
Amy, you remember that?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
So we our relationship evolved in a very natural way.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
sadly, we haven't seen a lot of each other recently because you retired in 2019 and we last saw each other in AME in New York
Right.
18 months ago. Two
Too
years.
briefly. Yeah.
2 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
November 24, right?
Right.
Coming up for 2 years. It's now May 26. So we've got quite a bit of history between us to cover, as well as your professional work. But if it's all right with you, Steve, I'd like to start with your early years and your family life. Now, I seem to remember, well, in fact, we had a brief conversation before we did this recording about your Italian connections. Toma is an Italian name, am I right?
It's sort of unknown. It was changed. Toma was not the name I was born with. The name I was born with was Toma, and it got changed. And my dad sort of, he was orphaned really young after the First War. So his background is a little sketchy. I think the more I've looked into it, I think he comes from sort of a mixture of areas. He has a little bit of Mediterranean Greek in him. I think he's got some Caucasus from Georgia and in that area. Because my mom always used to, when she got mad at him, would say he was a little Stalin. But my mom's side, and that's the side I really grew up with, is fully Italian. They came over, and my grandpa came over in 1907, and then
Over
my
to America, to New
and
York.
first through New York, but then he had a family connection in who worked on the railroad, and they set him up in Richmond, Indiana. So he was working in Indiana. It was a Pennsylvania Railroad, I think, hub there. And so that's where he was working. And then he went back to Italy for the Turkish Italian War.
Oh.
And then came back over to the States and picked up where he left off. And then he was drafted again in World War I, and he decided he wasn't going to go, and he joined the US Army and became a citizen that way. And then after the
Oh,
war,
did he have dual citizenship until then? Yes.
I mean, I think he was in the process of being naturalized, and then through the war that made it a sure thing.
Yeah, but your
And
mother,
so
sorry, Steve.
no, and then he went back and brought my mom, my grandma over, and then my mom was born actually in Richmond, but most of the family lived in the East Coast, and so they moved back there. I think my grandmother really demanded it, and so my mom grew up in the Newark area, right outside New York.
Oh. I seem to remember you mentioning your grandmother and her cooking.
She was a good cook. And she tried to teach me, but I had to try to figure out what a little of this and a little of that meant. And but yeah, she never really spoke English that well, and so it was a lot of sort of pidgin talk and gestures, and that's how I kind of communicated with her. And but she was great,
So
and a real.
that was your mother's mother.
Yeah, and she was, and like I say, my mom's side was really the side I grew up with.
So how was that? Was that a big sort of family or a three generational one?
It was not as big as some, because my uncle died in the Second War, and he had just gotten married but never had any kids. And so I had my aunt who'd never had any kids, and so there weren't many kid, you know, like first cousins or,
Mm.
but we had an extended sort of bunch of first cousins once removed kind of thing. And so I grew up with about five or six other cousins, and we'd go there in the summer and hang out and go to the Jersey Shore for a week. All the family would rent a house and we'd go down there, stuff like that.
So it was
So,
quite a big sort of Italian-oriented family.
yep, for
Yeah.
sure.
Yeah. What was your father working on then?
Well, he was a clinical psychologist. He came over as a teenager, and his older brother was in Rollins College in Florida, and so he went to high school there, and then stayed in the States going to school. And so he went to let's see, he went to college at, where'd he go to college? Went from I think it was I can't remember where he went to his BA, but he did his master's at Illinois and his PhD at Ohio State. Where'd he go? Kansas. Kansas.
How did he get to do all that from working on the railways?
No, that's my grandfather on the other
Ah, I
side.
beg your
Yeah.
pardon, I got mixed
No,
up.
my dad's side had money, but it was all lost in the collapse of you know, following the war and his dad being killed, and then his, you know, the business was kind of destroyed, and his older brother was 8 years older and sort of tried to keep things together. So I don't really know, but they had some money, I think, and they also had a real deep appreciation, actually both sides of the family. And I think that's what attracted my dad to my mom, was, you know, was this driving interest in education as a means forward. It wasn't so much getting a job or getting money. It was, you were always, you know, better off if you had education. And I remember my grandmother saying, talking about her brother in World War I on the front, and he could read and write, and he would make a killing, she said, getting cigarettes and food from home by reading people's letters that the priests had written for
Oh,
them.
yes.
And he would read them, and then he would take down what they wanted to say and send it back to them. And so so those are the kinds of stories I grew up with, that you'll never go hungry if you're educated. And so it was kind of funny that
So that was a very strong set of values and imperatives that
oh
you
yeah.
surrounded
Oh
by.
yeah,
So
for sure.
do you think that influenced you and your obvious ability at studying and or
Yeah.
you had a model from your father though, because he was
Yeah.
academic, wasn't he?
Yeah, and my mom. I mean, my mom you know, went to school on scholarships. She went to Montclair State. And you know, at a time when girls weren't supposed to. I mean, they didn't even let her ride a bike because they thought that was unladylike.
Yes.
So she went to school, and then she started her master's program at Columbia and was working with Margaret Mead.
Wow.
If she had been on her own, I think she would have had a nice career. It was at the time when they were doing there was a big interest in the post-war period about, you know, high schools, these big, large high schools, and what it was doing to the youth. And one of the things they were hoping for were people to go in as sort of observers. And mom was real young looking, and so she was asked to go in and sort of be a fake student to see what the girls were talking about and all this kind of stuff. So yeah, she had a good, yeah, that was her start, and then she worked on projects in the Boston area, and so she was a master's level anthropologist.
This was before she met your father.
No, she met this was when she was 11 years younger than him. And so she met him in New York City at the International House. Somebody had said, let's go to the Columbia International House and see what's going on. There's a party in 46, I think it was. And she met a couple people. My dad was one of them. And
Did she?
that was a big deal, because she was supposed to marry a nice Italian boy, and
So
from the neighborhood. Yeah.
she could have been an academic herself.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, she enjoyed the work. She
Yeah.
did some, she particularly the field work,
Yeah.
which was me too. I like the actual, getting into the problem and try to
Yeah.
tinker with it and work it through.
Well, let's come on
Yeah.
to that a bit. And I mean, is there anything you'd like to say about your formal education before going to
Well,
university? Is there anything you especially remember that might be relevant to what subsequently turned out to be your interests?
yeah, I think a little bit that just that the schools that my dad and mom sort of got me into were pretty much experimental schools. Like my high school only had 12 kids in my graduating class, and they were all sort of based on sort of a more of a free, open kind of schooling that was very different than the 50s style, and so on. And I think the idea of what school was like and the impact it had on people and in their development in particular was, I think, started, if I have to look back, I think in those experiences and how they were so different than other kids' experiences. So, for instance, when I went to live in Germany in 67, 68, I went to school on a US base. Army base or military base, and it was built around a traditional Midwestern high school, junior high kind of place, and it was so different and jarring, really, but it was good experience. And the same thing happened after high school when I was almost set. I don't know if you know this, but I was set to go to England for my BA.
No.
And yeah, the Sussex. And it was something my dad was really keen on doing. I think part of it was because of the Vietnam War and stuff like that. He wanted me out of the country. But it was
Yeah.
his idea. And I kind of chafed a little under that. But I got into Sussex, and I graduated high school in at Christmas. So I had a semester. And I said, well, let me, he didn't want me to do nothing or just work at a sort of a pickup job. So he said, go to school. And so I went to UMass, and the deal was it was just for a semester, and I could stay in the area and be with my friends and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then we'll reassess the Sussex thing, because I didn't think it was really deserved. It was something that was concocted by my dad and mom and a friend of his at Harvard who had written a letter for me and those sorts of things. So, to make a long story short, I insisted on staying, and so I stayed at UMass. But there it was, I came out of a high school, like I said, with a graduating class of 12, and I went into my first psych class that had 320. And
Wow.
so it was just so the point I'm making is that there's been these experiences of different educational environments that
School
just kind
staff,
of,
yeah.
yeah. That sort of called the question about what does this do to people to have these kind of different environments. So that I think was important to me,
Yeah, that's
in
really
thinking about,
interesting. Because your father was at Harvard, wasn't he?
he went to do his postdoc there,
Postdoc,
and because he got his PhD at Ohio State, he did his postdoc there. And he went out to Kansas, and that was his first job. And my mom hated it. And so they went back to Cambridge, and he decided to go into private practice. And so he did that for a while, and then he worked for
Was he a clinical psychologist
yeah,
then?
clinical.
Yeah.
And that was yeah, and so he was working with particularly rehab and people coming out of the wars with with handicaps of some sort and
Yeah.
helping them. And so we would have on Sundays sometimes people come over who, were kind of in rough shape, and my brother and I would always, kind of say, "You're sitting next to him." It was,
Yeah.
just little kid stuff, but
Yeah. And your
it was
brother's older than you.
younger. I'm the
Younger,
eldest.
younger. Yeah. Interesting. I noticed on your CV, which you kindly shared with me, that you had several years at University of Massachusetts Amherst, longer than no longer than the normal 3 years, right, for a BA. So what you've explained accounts for that extra time. Yeah.
Well, I quit. I quit for a year and a half, or I took some time off and worked. And I was convinced that I could make my way without without having to deal with all that. And so, I'd been sort of moving around in majors. I'd started out in biology and then went to entomology and then to ethology. And then I said, I don't know. So I worked for a congressman for a while, very liberal, actually a priest, Congressman Drynan. And so I came back thinking, well, maybe I want to go to poli sci. And so then I went back and finished up. And I decided, no, I was more interested in what, naive little kid, I was more interested in what makes people tick. And so I gave up on the idea of animals and went right to humans. And
So in a way, you are a mix of your parents' interests.
yeah, pretty much.
Yes, I think I could say the same actually, but we won't get into that. But it's interesting how these things happen. After Massachusetts, you went to Minnesota to do your PhD. Well, that's quite a big difference, I imagine, not just in a distance, but also culturally.
Yeah, I mean it was calculated in the sense that a lot of my professors had been either East Coast kind of Ivy types or West Coast Big Ten, big large state schools. And I had been sort of wondering about what to do next. And I had interests in measurement statistics, and then I had interests in personality and social development, with education as sort of the context within that occurs, right? So I said to the people I had been working with on projects as an undergraduate, what do you suggest? And they said, if you don't really want to prioritize one over the other, then go to a place that, or that's good in both. And the ones that were good in both tended to be Big Ten schools. And so I applied to Illinois, and I applied to Indiana and Northwestern and Minnesota. And so then I had some choices to make. And Jim Rest was the one who seemed to be most interested in me. And it
Yeah.
was, I mean, there's no really good reason why I pick one over the other, but he met me at the train station. I had gone with a bunch of people I'd worked with to Chicago. And so I was, near Illinois, near Indiana, near, so I was going to go look at the schools that I might go to. And he said, "Well, come on up." And so I got on the train and went to Minneapolis, and he met me there. He had forgotten that they had changed stations, so I was wondering if I'd made a terrible mistake because I was waiting and waiting. And then he shows up in a rush and apologizes. And so we went out and talked, and he showed me where he worked in the center and sort of what I might be doing and the coursework I might be taking. And he said, "Do you want to spend the night since we were delayed?" And I said, "No, I've got my ticket back." But he was the one who really shared what he was doing and how I might fit in. The other folks talked more about the opportunities I might have, kind of thing. And this would be your curriculum. Here's a sheet, and this is what you would choose between, and it's a good school, kind of thing.
Jim really took an interest in you as a
Right.
person, as a scholar, young scholar, and he was absolutely seminal and catalytic to your professional life, wasn't he, in development
Oh, absolutely.
and initially at this stage a mentor.
Yep. But not initially, and that was kind of funny. No, I mean, when I got there, I was sort of, whoa. I mean, because he was busy doing his thing. He immediately told me once I had accepted the invitation, admission, that he was going to Harvard for sabbatical.
Oh dear.
So he said, but Jeanette Lawrence would take care of you, and that was one of his students who was nearing the end of her program, going back to Australia, and she was great. She
Well,
was like my,
that's extraordinary that you've just
yeah.
mentioned her, because
Oh, yeah.
I was thinking, as you said the name, could it possibly be the same person who was on the JME editorial board for many years? And it was. Wow.
And
And
she was my advisor when I got there. Really, I mean, she
wow.
gave me the straight scoop, and she was great. And so I didn't miss Jim that much, because I had somebody who was really keen on imparting what she had learned to me. And so
Well, that's
it was fun.
amazing, because I only met her once, because of course she was in Australia,
Right.
and she once came over to Britain and to an editorial board meeting that happened to occur when she was over here.
Yeah,
I
she was
do remember
great.
her as a lively lady.
And
Wow.
so when she left and Jim came back, then there was a sort of a period where he was sort of watching, to see what I was doing. And I think he was I always appreciated him, and I don't mean to say anything other than that, but there was a certain kind of calculation about him, in the sense that he knew he had a bunch of students, he knew he had limited time, and so he would sort of vet the young ones first, to see who might be helpful and who might not. And so
So he
after
was
my
careful about who he let in to work with him, really.
I think I think so. I mean, I think he had been burned a couple of times, is my guess, that he had invested a lot of time and effort, and it didn't pan out. And so I think he had, and I've heard this from other faculty members as well, is you kind of hold your cards close to the vest at first, and you see how they're going to perform and what their interests are, and whether you see a point of intersection or not, and then you start ramping it up and see how things work out. And I think my first year, that was sort of what he was doing.
So this was
And
in about late 70s, through to 85, right? Something like that. Yeah.
And I stayed a year afterwards,
In your postdoc.
I sort of a yeah I taught and continued working on the projects.
Yes, because I see in your CV you did quite a bit of teaching alongside doing the PhD.
Yeah, that was sort of required, or it was seen as a good thing to do, because the job market was constricting at the time. They always, I always used to hear about baby boomers having such a great time of it. The universities were expanding, blah blah blah. But if you were on the late side of the baby boomer range, it things were constricting a bit. So the idea was to be as broad-based as you could, so that you could appeal. So teaching was important, in case you had to emphasize that. skill sets, expand them, beef up your statistics, beef up your measurement.
Teaching
And
distracting though from your own study.
yeah, a little bit. But I think it was just sort of what was expected, and you had to figure it out, how to do both.
How to balance it.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. We might come back to that.
Okay.
Don't know if you want to say more about Jim at this point. Because you continued working with him long after you left
Oh yeah. I mean
Minnesota,
he was great, yeah.
and so at the beginning, he would have been in mid-career.
Yeah, I would think that's about right. And he had I think he had developed the defining issues test. It was just starting to hit its stride. He had I think come out of Kohlberg's shadow a bit.
Would you please
And
say a bit more about that connection?
yeah, I think well, Jim worked with him in Chicago, and then I hope I have this all right. And then when Kohlberg went to Harvard College of Education, I think Jim finished up at Chicago. And then went to Cambridge to sort of work at the center. And he started out running a lot of the center, or at least was actively involved there. And that's
Center
where he
for
got,
Moral Education.
yeah. And that's where he got the idea for the DIT, because he would become frustrated scoring and saying, I wish I could just ask the person, Do you, yeah, and show him the key and say, is this what you mean or is that what you mean? And so he said, there's got to be a way. And he was pretty political. And so he saw that there was a limit to what, how far the field could grow if everyone was focused on the interview, because it was time intensive. It was sort of, it required a deep training in the field.
This is the moral
And
judgment interview.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes. And so he thought there had to be some other way. And so as he worked on the DIT, I think it was, in a way, it wasn't appreciated necessarily by the Harvard group. And they saw it as sort of a quick and dirty screener kind of measure. And I think I remember, like, when Kohlberg would come every once in a while, and we had the DIT was up and running, it was becoming very popular. We were scoring, boxes of DITs for people, and he brought Kohlberg into our scoring area, and we had a scanner, and we had, we put the DITs in the scanner and would zip through and get scored, and out would come the person's scores. And he said to Kohlberg, look, moral judgment scoring, hands-off moral judgment scoring, is something, I have butchered it, but it was, and Kohlberg just shook his head and laughed. But it was, just so counter to what the Harvard group was working on,
Yeah, where it was much more laborious.
there was an art to it, and a real need to understand language, and beyond just moral theory and measurement
Yeah,
issues.
communication, in fact.
Yeah, yeah.
So, just to try and get the chronology a bit clearer.
Right.
So Jim Rest would have been at Harvard with Larry Kohlberg and a whole load of other people like Fritz Oser and Clark Power.
Yeah, and he remembers Ann Colby Fondly and
Colby,
Bill Damon, I think, that group, yeah.
that whole group. And that would have been in the 70s, right? Yeah. And
And
then
then he got the job. Then he got the job at Minnesota.
so that would have been late 70s, Jim. Yeah. So the he kind of was a bit of an offshoot, if you like.
I
He
mean,
took himself off, right?
the branch, the tree branch branched with him, and so he was no longer sort of a traditional Kohlbergian. He became sort of a neo-Kohlbergian.
Yes. So
And
could
so,
you say a bit more about that, Steve, what that meant, and also say a little bit more about the defining issues test, which you've already mentioned, because it's very critical to the development of cognitive moral development and also to your own work.
I think that, well, the defining issues test was very much driven by the interview, in that the dilemmas that a person would read were basically distillations of Kohlberg's dilemmas that he used in his interview method. And the items were really real life answers that people had given to the Kohlberg interview, boiled down and, sort of made into a standard format. And so what the person would do would be to read the dilemma and then answer a quick question about what should say Heinz and the drug. I don't need to say more about that, do I?
No,
Heinz and
probably
there. All right. So it'd be, what should Heinz do? Steal the drug, can't decide, or do nothing.
Yeah.
And so that really didn't matter in the scoring of the measure, but it was to get somebody thinking about what should the protagonist do. And then you were given a list of about 12 items that define the issue of the Heinz dilemma in terms of Kohlbergian stages to start. So that there would be conventional items. There'd be post-conventional items. So, whether it's only natural for a loving husband to care so much for his wife that he'd steal would be kind of, sort of pre-conventional kinds of thinking. And then you'd have stealing the drug would only encourage more theft and, sort of more of a conventional. And so anyway, so then the person would go through these items and sort of rate each one. And that was just to get them to think about each individual item in it on its own. And then the genius of the measure was at the end when it said, all right, now think about all the items. Which would you think is the most important? And second, third, and fourth. And all the indices from the DIT came from those four ranked items, because what the person is doing then is just stepping back, considering all the different options, and then saying these are the best ones. So it's a second pass through the information. And so what he would do would be he would look at how many of those ranked items were post-conventional items, and that would be his famous P score, which would be the percentage of time a person would select a post-conventional item as most important, and there'd be six dilemmas, so across six dilemmas. And he found that the P score was actually a pretty good proxy for what Kohlberg was finding with his measure, in that if there was a trend found on the DIT, I mean on the interview, it would be also found on the DIT. If Kohlberg found age educational trends, so also on the DIT. Links to behavior, same on the DIT. So it was working as the theory suggested, but not exactly the same, so that there was, he had to look at stages in a little bit different way. Whereas Kohlberg had sort of a very clear hierarchy, what the DIT was suggesting was that there was more fluidity across, so that there was waves, more percentages, more or less than And so, and that was built into the measurement, whereas Kohlberg's system tended to try to avoid mixtures as much as possible and to try to hone in on the dominance structure that the person was using to define the measure, the dilemma. And so that sort of beginning led Jim more and more to question the kind of model that Kohlberg was kind of assuming for his measurement system. And it became so the stages be started to shrink, and it was more of a shifting distributions of strategies that we saw more and more often. And this sort of just accelerated when Blasi had
Not
his,
Blasi,
yeah, I
yeah.
guess Blasi, his paper in 80 about the judgment and action gap,
Yes.
which, you know, made the case that, you know, either we got to do a better job of measuring the link between judgment and action, or this is really truly what we have, which is a small to middling effect, which implies that there's got to be something else involved. And so Jim sort of, and I was in the seminars then, so we would talk a lot about this, and he would say, all right, so logically, does it make sense that all the studies are underestimating the effect, and it's actually pretty large and supports this sort of strong connection between one's moral cognitions and one's action. And we looked at and we said, okay, let's look at the studies that we have with the DIT, for instance. Which ones do you think are better studies? And we said, well, these seem to be better. The samples are, you know, drawn more adequately. The samples are large. The actual action they're using is appropriate. What's the size of the effect? And it was middling, you know, it wasn't super large. So during the course of that year of 80, 81, 82, I think we all came to the conclusion, I think Jim way before us, that there was something else. And our job then switched gears a bit to not just working on the DIT as try to refine it, try to test it in different areas, although that kept going. It was to try to figure out what else is there. And that was what developed into REST four component model. And
Just to be clear, we've got sort of the early 80s now, and you spent about 8 years altogether in Jim's center, right? And so by then you'd finished, or you were finishing up your PhD, but you were doing the teaching, you're working on a daily basis with him and other colleagues, right?
Correct. And and he had hired me to go through the literature, and this was actually something that stuck with me, was he was saying, there's can we learn anything from sort of affiliated areas about what other things might be involved in judgment and action, not just in the moral area, but maybe in pro-social behavior or pro-social reasoning or something else. And so he had me one summer, he paid me to just go to the library basically and go through different areas that we agreed on that might be of interest. And so I would be reading in personality and social, I'd be reading in social development, I'd be reading, oh, in just a host of different areas, even in clinical. And you know, we found areas that might help us, and that sort of went into the four component model. You know, that there is something about moral sensitivity. There's something about judgment. We'd already talked about judgment with the DIT and Kohlberg's measure and all that, but there are other things. So sensitivity, judgment, motivation. So where, how much does the person sort of elevate the moral, and then the sort of moral action component, which was it was the toughest one to really label, but it was kind of like, how does the person actually go about doing the action? I mean, you could be sensitive to it, you could reason about it, you could be motivated to act, but if you can't figure out how to do it, it all falls apart. So in each one of those areas was a cluster of processes, and those processes could be measured. And it was our job then to figure out how to measure them and put them together and support the model. And that's sort of what we were all doing. And I was part of that. Mickey Bebo looked at moral sensitivity and sort of focused on that. There were people looking at moral motivation. Mickey also did some work in the professions with moral implementation, what she called the fourth component. But I stuck pretty much with component two and tried to think of within the judgment process, were there other ways to look at what might influence a moral judgment, and and how it might link with the other processes. And so that was really what I did with my dissertation and
But it was
subsequently.
interesting because Jim was encouraging you in that summer reading and so on to broaden an understanding of what was involved in what shall we say, moral awareness, thinking, and action, right? That it was a broader. A broader approach from what had gone before, in especially in a Kohlbergian sense. Yeah. So does this mean, is that what you would count as neo-Kohlbergian then?
Yeah, pretty much. And then it became even more neo when we sort of left the stages behind and called them schemas, that they were more social cognitive components that were more probabilistic and not reflections of the individual so much. So
And this is where, of course, all your training in measurement and statistics also came in handy, right? And you were able to deal with it in that sort of way that was much more precise in
And I think that was my role pretty much in the group, was to try to figure out a way of operationalizing things.
Before we move on to your career proper, you also, of course, met someone else in Minnesota whom you've referred to already, who was of long lasting influence and co-working with you, Mickey Bebo, and I remember her mainly for her work with dentistry and dental students. But you may have had a sort of broader affiliation conception of her work.
Yeah, she would come to our seminars, and that's how I first met her. She was an assistant professor at the time. She had come into the I think the field later. She had been in music, in music education, and got her PhD in Arizona, I think, in ed psych, and then had was very good at packaging ideas from psychology and education and transporting it into professional settings. And she was a performer. I mean, she was really good at figuring out how to best present and articulate ideas. And so she was hired, I think in part because of her the need for dentist den schools of medicine and dentistry to talk about ethics in their profession. And she was able to be a force that would not wilt under Dennis kind of skepticism. She was a tough, cookie when it came to holding her own with a lot of professionals who thought that, talking about ethics was a waste of curricular space, and she was very politically savvy. And so I got to know her when she, we were talking about different things, and we started working on a couple of projects that she had in the dental school. And Jim was really keen on that work too, I think, because it was a good way of starting to look at some of the other processes, like motivation. So if you think of professional ethics and how do people sort of prioritize that part of their professional understanding, it really became a really sort of efficient way of looking at how maybe moral motivation might work more generally. And so she so we started working, and I would help with the methods and the talk about the analysis and critique the measures and stuff. And she would be intersecting with the dentist to come up with the sort of the actual focus of the assessment. And it was really, really helpful, and it opened up ideas about where I might go. I did not have her skill set, and she would help me sometimes about, you need to say it this way. This is better. And she said when I was on the job market, she would say, "Okay, you got your job talk ready?" And I said, "Yeah." She goes, "Come on over and give it to me." And so I'd go over and give it to her, and she would say, "All right, now this isn't going to work, this part. You're going to have to do this." And yeah, I tend to get down in the weeds, as you probably know. And so she would try to give constructive feedback, and I always appreciated that a lot.
Yeah, she was. I remember she was a strong but very personable lady.
Oh yeah,
Yeah,
yeah.
and you wouldn't mess with her. But on the other hand, she was very considerate
Oh yeah.
and she's very very pleasant to be with. A strong lady, right? So,
Yeah.
she helped you out really when you were
Oh,
needing to
very.
move from Minnesota. And so tell
Yeah,
me about
Jim was not, I'm sorry, go ahead.
no, whatever
I
you
was
want.
just going to say Jim was not particularly helpful in feedback on things like talks and stuff like that. But Mickey was, and so the two of them combined helped me out a lot. I mean, Jim was, of course, really good at conceptualization, all the stuff that made him who he was, but in terms of here's a better way to pitch this idea, that was Mickey's sort of input for me.
So she was very useful to him in getting his ideas
Oh yeah.
across and better known
Yeah.
and transferred to, as you say, professional ethics, which was
Yep.
important
Yep.
in developing the range of application, if you like.
I don't doubt that she did what for me what she did for Jim, Yeah.
Now we're getting to about 1986, if I've got this right.
Right.
And
Right.
just to say, I first met Jim in Japan in 1987.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, that may be not quite right.
I thought you came to the Minnesota conference, the ice storm conference.
When was that?
It was when I was a grad student, because I remember
Well, the first time I went to AME was 85, Toronto. Next year was Chicago, which we've already mentioned.
yeah.
And
Oh, maybe it was 84, I'll bet.
I didn't know. The very first was
Yeah.
85.
Yeah. All right. So you
Yeah.
must have missed
Yeah.
A4.
So I think even if I'd come across Jim in 85 or 6, he hadn't sort of really impinged on me. Of course, he was a rather quiet gentleman,
Yeah.
and quite self-contained, I seem to remember really. And in 87, a few of us, including Anne Higgins and Lisa Kumacher and Jim, Tom Licona, myself, were invited by Nobu Iwasa to
Ah, yeah.
Japan for the first time, right?
I saw the pictures, yeah.
Yes, and we also, because the Japanese are amazing hosts, we also did some cultural tours, which were, a real eye-opener, and my first truck with the East, really, and the others, right? Probably two. So I'm trying to remember, but because there's another person we must mention in relation to Jim, and that of course is Dasha Nevaeth. Yeah, and you've done a lot of work with her, and she was my successor as editor. So, but at what point did she come to work with Jim? That's my question that I'm a bit unsure about
It
the
was
time.
after I left.
After you left, okay.
Yeah, 'cause I met her at AME as well.
Okay. Oh, well,
And he, and Jim introduced me to her as a student of his.
yes, yeah. Because I think I'm right in saying in 87, when we were in Japan, Jim was still married to his
Right, with
wife.
Anne. Yeah.
And did they have any children, daughters?
Yeah, they
Yeah.
had a daughter.
Sure. Yeah.
Now I've forgotten her name now.
That's what I seem to remember. So I was just wondering about the chronology. Yeah. So we're getting you to where you spent, I think, if my calculation is right, some 33 years in at University of Alabama, and you rose through the ranks, right? Through all the ranks, assistant professor, associate. I always get those two things mixed up, but anyway, there is an order, I know. Were in the Department of Human Development and Family Studies,
The
and
start, yeah.
yeah, when you started, and then you became professor, chair, so on. But come back to this because I need a bit of clarification about some of these things. But this, we're talking about this big period of 33 years, 1986 to 2019, when you retired. That's a lot of years, and a lot of research, teaching, and service, as is indicated in your CV. I suppose the first question is, how did you get from Minnesota to Alabama? Slightly different places, and as already mentioned, you conveyed me between you conveyed me between St. Louis, which is definitely towards the Minnesota area, down to Alabama, and you can feel as you're moving in the car the changes of the location, the people, the nature of the places, and so on. So a very different scenario, I imagine.
And it was certainly not planned. In 86 when I came out, there were very few jobs. I think I only applied to two, and Alabama was the one that called me in. I was looking, I didn't want to go to just a teaching job, right? I wanted to have a job where I could do my research as well. And so I went down to Alabama, and the other benefit of Alabama was that Amy, my wife, was working with the Treasury at the time, the US Treasury, and she was headquartered in DC. And so we were looking for a place where we could both continue our careers. And it just so happened that the Treasury had a regional office in Birmingham, which is about 40 minutes from Tuscaloosa. And so we thought, well, I could get my foot in the door. She could transfer down to Birmingham. We could live in Birmingham and I'd commute down to Tuscaloosa. And we had just learned that Sarah was, well, Sarah was on the horizon, my first child, and so we were going to live in Birmingham, and I would do the commuting. And oh, and it was going to be just a short-term deal.
Yes.
That I was just going to get in, get sort of feet wet, and then see what if the market opened, I could go back home or do something else. And so I started out, and Sarah came. Amy decided that she would take a hiatus to be with Sarah. And then we moved to Tuscaloosa, and it just seemed like the roots started growing. I kept looking for jobs, and I applied for a couple that I almost got in, but it wasn't successful. I almost went to Indiana. I almost went to Boston College, but that was a little bit off the, a little, that wasn't as clear. And then when Nick came along, my son, we decided wasn't a good time to uproot everything and go all over the place. So we're just going to suck it up and stay for a while. And that stay for a while ended up being 30 years. It's amazing how quickly it went.
Can you describe what Tuscaloosa and University of Alabama was like in 1986 or so?
Yeah, it was actually kind of interesting, and this is what appealed to me. They had a new president. I thought I'd never forget his name, but he was an Alabama boy who went to Harvard and had gone into, I think it was biology, and had developed a really strong academic career, and then was sort of interested in going home. And so he took the job at Alabama, and his position was that sports and being a party school was not going to be what made Alabama thrive. And so he said, we're going to have to really focus on bringing in academics who have strong research interests, and we have to move forward in that. And all my efforts are going to be to drive that forward. And the Board of Trustees, I guess, was on board, and they looked at all the money that was available for research, I think, and that sort of sealed the deal. And so I was in the first class there that were brought in with where the priority was on research skills. And there
Wow.
were And the cohort was really interesting. They were mostly from the Big Ten, so it was very familiar. My friends were from Michigan, Illinois. I had a friend from where was it? Missouri, which is now different then. But so we were all kind of we thought we were big stuff, and we were going to make a move. We were given a lot of resources. We had reduced teaching loads. We were given summer money to work on our research, and at the same time, it was very clear that we were going to be scrutinized. It wasn't going to be just a free ride, and they kept bringing in people, so the place was changing dramatically. And it was fun for me in a way to help build, and I really did appreciate that. And the downside was that because I became somewhat vocal about how things should be, that I got sucked into being on committees and then being in administration. And it cut both ways. But there was something heady about being an assistant professor, having being listened to about maybe who should we hire next, right? And the place really grew, and it's the rankings increased, the quality of students increased, the foreign student population just doubled. And by the time I left, the population of the school was only about 51% from Alabama. The rest were from California, New Jersey, Michigan. They had done a really good job of marketing the school outside the state. And so it was a, it, the population became closer and closer to what I experienced at Minnesota.
And what about the student population, not just the academic staff, but the students, right? Because you should describe Alabama, Tuscaloosa, for those people who've not had the privilege of going there, as I did with you and your wife, and you took me to an all-black college and to an
In a
event,
Stillman, yeah.
and I think I'm right in saying we were probably the only three white people in this auditorium.
Yeah, that's probably true.
And so that's just to illustrate how that was in about 2010, if I remember rightly. We're talking here about 20 years before that. So the student population would have been pretty well black, right? Or,
Alabama?
yeah.
No.
No.
Hundred. Oh no, that was one of the big issues was it was Alabama was the white school. I mean,
Oh, really?
it was the vestige of the civil rights sort of problems.
Oh,
It
so that's
was just
what you were concerned about to some extent.
And
Sorry,
so,
it wasn't clear about that.
no, Stillman was the black school across the railroad tracks. I mean, it was really a southern town, and it was it, Tuscaloosa had been sort of a well, I think before the university it was a military school initially, and then it was its job was to feed the Confederacy with troop, with officers at one point. And so,
I got this completely wrong.
no, yeah, I know that was one of the scandals was when they looked at the black population in the state and the black population at the University of Alabama and Auburn University, the other sort of school, the big, state school. And it was blacks were way under represented. And so there was a concerted effort, and that got better while I was there. But it was still the sense that it was the planter's sons, would go to Alabama, and you would have all the governors would have come from Alabama because it had the law school,
Right.
and and so it was a ticket for Alabama advancement was the University of Alabama, and of course the sports and all that hoopla. But it was a different sort of world. I mean, I had never been further south than Washington, D.C., and so to be in the deep south was kind of jarring. But on campus, it didn't have that kind of feel. It like I say, most of the people I interacted with were from other places, and the Tuscaloosa itself became much more cosmopolitan. Well, I can't say cosmopolitan, but it would be much more representative of the rest of the country.
So there was a the beginning, in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, there would have been quite a contrast between the university then, and the surrounding population in Tuscaloosa, who would have been mainly white. I'm sorry, mainly black, and the university mainly white.
Well, the city is actually about Tuscaloosa is about 60-40 white black.
Now.
No, I think back then too.
Back then too. Oh,
You may have had sort of a skewed view of it because we went to
yes, maybe
the
I
other
did.
side.
And
And
also,
remember we drove around neighborhoods and stuff. So
we did.
and so
And
you
also, because I was interested in that because of my other, and also on my train trips, I remember mainly black people on the trains.
Yeah, that's probably true in the South, yeah.
Especially going up from Tuscaloosa to Washington,
Right.
people getting on and off the train. So, I'm sorry for having been presumptuous about that, but interesting. How would you put a percentage now on this black
I
steel
think
carbide?
I read somewhere it doubled from when I started there, but that's still not super progressive. I think I think it's like about 25%, 26% now of the population on campus is black. It has a large population relative to other state schools, but it's in Alabama, it's still underrepresented of the population of the state.
So the black students are still going to Stillman College and places like.
Well, I think some, if they want to stay home, I think the good students would go maybe to some of the historically black schools in Atlanta, Emory, maybe,
Yeah,
because
not so far.
or up to Birmingham,
Yes.
and Alabama.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of resources set aside to recruit. So but I think it would be hard for particularly in the 80s for a black student to come on campus at a school that had, oh, maybe 20 years earlier had almost rioted to keep blacks from enrolling.
I hadn't remembered or been aware of
You
that.
remember the Governor Wallace, George
Oh
Wallace,
yes.
standing in the schoolhouse door. Well, that was in Tuscaloosa. That
That was
was,
in Tuscaloosa.
yeah, there was a building where they would register, which the first year I was there, I registered people in that building. And they would and he stood in front of that door so that no one could come in and register for classes. And then, of course, the troops that were federalized opened the way, and a few African Americans were enrolled, and they had a tough time. I mean, I heard one was a College of Education graduate, and she came back and talked about her experiences. And it would have been, I don't know, the how tough it would have been. I mean, she conveyed it how tough it was, but I couldn't imagine being in her shoes. And that now they've, done, they've created sort of memorials to her time there and her peers. But it's still I think fresh in people's minds.
Well, you did take me to Selma and those,
Yep.
I misremembered or not got clear about this.
Yeah, we went over the bridge that
Did.
Martin Luther King and everyone walked over.
We did. It was very meaningful.
Yeah.
Just to finish off about before we get back to the moral part of your work, rising through the ranks in the University of Alabama, you were professor. You were professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Studies, and then you were chair of that department, right? Which is the admin.
Before I was full, I think I started
Yes,
as an associate. Yeah.
that's right. A year before, a year before you became professor. That was kind of interesting, and then you became a professor and coordinator of the educational psychology program in the Department of Educational Studies in Psychology, etc.
Yeah.
I'm reading these all out because I'm a bit confused. And
Yeah,
then,
I changed colleges at that point.
And then.
And I was getting increasingly frustrated with the movement in HDF in human development, that we had developed some programs, and I didn't think they were really moving forward. I didn't think the quality of the students were particularly good. And so I talked to some of my friends who I'd been working with in doing some of these joint programs. They were all joint with psychology and with education. And so I said, what do you think about me moving over there. And that was kind of a it was important because it was a lease on life, really, to change sort of settings over there. And
Oh,
the ed psych program was had was attracting a better crop of students, and I felt more at home there. And there had been a change in the leadership of human development, and I had and I just didn't think it was gonna change much more in my lifetime there. So I said I either have to leave, and the family was sort of entrenched by that time. They were all in school and wanted to stay.
yeah.
And so
Because by then you'd been there, what, 12, 18 years?
yeah, they were in high school,
Yeah,
with junior high and high school, and so they didn't want to uproot at that point. And Amy was teaching, so it just didn't make much sense to just pull everyone up and try to find something new.
So you switched department colleges.
I switched colleges, and
And then after about 2 or 3 years, you became director of your own Center for the Study of Ethical Development.
yeah, they gave me the opportunity. And then when Mickey was retiring and
He
Darsha had
couldn't
le
come.
yeah and Darsha had left to go to Notre Dame,
This has left
Minnesota,
Minnesota.
yeah, sorry, yeah, then I took it over,
Yes, and you took it back to Alabama.
right,
Yeah,
where
this
it
was
remains in some
2009.
form now. Yeah.
So is that still going?
Yes, its focus has changed a little with David Walker took over
Yes.
the position, and his training is a bit different, and he's interested more in I would say I'm sort of in more in the educational process, more in character education. And so he's brought it more in that direction
Was
than the
his
traditional.
background was in the army, I seem to recall. He's a Brit.
He's a Brit. I met him at the Jubilee Center.
Yeah.
He was in the army and then got his degree in sociology
Yeah.
from Durham,
Yeah.
and then went to the Jubilee Center and became interested in sort of character education in the professions, and worked specifically in the military profession. So when I was with the Jubilee Center for those few years, we worked together on measuring sort of character issues in junior officers at Sandhurst, and
Ah,
in
yeah.
there it was a lot of fun. And he was good. He had both the cultural and the setting knowledge, and so it was fun to work with him. And then when he was looking for a more permanent position than the Jubilee Center, I said, well, come to Alabama. And
So just before we have you parked in Alabama, right, and we can
right.
get to your work, a couple of things I don't understand, because you seem to have been professor 1, 2, 3, 4 times with different labels. So there's professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Studies, professor in the Educational Psychology Program,
Right.
Paul W. Bryant, Professor of Education, and then
Yep.
University Research Professor. And as I stated at the beginning,
Yep.
you're now emeritus,
Yep.
right? Retired.
Right.
So, what's the difference in all these titles?
You get your degree within the college, right? So I rose to the ranks and got a professorship in human development, right? And then when I moved to College of Education, they had to admit me as a professor. So I had to go through a vetting process. And then my title shifted to my home. And then the Bryant Professorship was a
That's not.
yeah, it was an honorarium kind of honor, And then the University Research Professorship is a acknowledgement of your career, really. And they elevate you, they give you a raise, they give you money to support students and other parts of your research. And so that was a nice way to end. I had a little slush fund that I could take
Indeed.
students to conferences and stuff like that. And
Indeed, because we all know how much time we have to spend raising research money from
absolutely.
places and so on. It's a big drain on one's time and energy usually. So that would have been nice. And
And then when you retire, the dean puts you up for emeritus,
yes,
because
of course, yeah.
and then the board of trustees votes on that.
Yeah, because not everybody gets it, do they?
No, I think yeah, because there's some connection to the university that persists after you retire if you're emeritus. Like technically, I could have a little space there, and
Oh, yes.
but I think they've forgotten me. I retired in 19. I think I was forgotten by probably the fall semester of the 20s. So,
I think you're being, as usual,
no,
modest. Right.
I.
So let's see about the work, right?
Okay.
Because in inviting you for this conversation, I asked you to nominate some publication of yours. I said you could have six, right? And
Yeah.
the criteria were personally satisfying, academically well received, and or influential on research or practice. Now, they're not necessarily the same thing, those criteria, right?
No.
And I had a little count up, and I reckon from your CV you've got around 88 publications. I may have missed some, it might be more, so I don't mean to do you down. They're mostly in journals, a wide range of journals, mostly psychological, and in some books. And I noticed that you had, I think it was one, two, three, about five published in the JME. And I'm surprised to that it was not till 2000 that you had the first one in JME, and then more since I've been editor, so I hope I didn't have anything to do with that.
No.
That's just an accident of what you are working on,
I think that's right. And
what
also, I think it was an attempt to, I remember Jim saying early on that AME was how we wanted to get our ideas out to our friends.
Yes, well, that was another thing. I
Yeah.
noticed that you, which I knew, of course, that you were a very regular presenter at the Association for Moral Education annual
Right.
conferences, but also I saw at AERA, American
Yep.
Educational Research Association, you went there pretty regularly. You would have given different types of presentations at those
Right.
two places and so now.
Right.
I'm going to ask you a potentially awkward question that I also asked Larry Walker recently, who's just preceded you as a
Right.
my conversationist, because I noticed you, like him, don't seem to have had any separate book publications. I should qualify this by saying that I'm a philosopher turned educational researcher, not a psychologist.
Yeah.
I think the answer may be this is less a separate book publication is less often the case than in my two disciplines. Is that so?
Yeah, I mean, I served on a bunch of tenure promotion committees over the years, and the advice I got and the advice I gave was that the system prioritizes research grants and research reports, and that books are good, and particularly if they're a way of summarizing your work over, an area or something. But if you're looking to get promoted, don't do books. And that's a little too blunt, but that was the message that we got, because what they would do is they'd say, "What's your contribution to the field?" And they could quantify that this you've been getting articles into peer-reviewed outlets that are highly recognized by your field. That's the kind of information they want to see. A book contract with a publisher that, I don't know how many books you sell. That's harder to really quantify. I mean, the fact that you got a contract is important. But I always got the sense that that if you were going to spend time writing a book, and in so doing you kind of avoided writing a couple of papers, you were kind of hurting yourself a little bit. But it's also the case that the way I was going about things didn't always lend itself to books. So that may be just sort of self-serving, because book chapters was one way I could summarize stuff that probably was too much for a journal article, but a book would require something a little bit different than what I was doing and thinking about. So I suppose I mean, I worked with other people on books, and I would take a chunk and they would take a chunk and we'd put it together. But in terms of me sitting down saying, "This is, what Steve
Book.
Toma thinks," and I never really thought much about that, but I do see it as kind of a regret now, because it would have been fun.
Do you think you could do it now?
I don't think so. I don't think I have. My connection to the field is starting to get dimmer and dimmer, and I do, like I said to you before, my resources are all in Alabama. So, and getting into libraries is, and that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
So
very
no,
daunting.
I don't think so. And what I would say is also getting more and more dated, I would think. But I still help out with people who are writing things. But that's getting less and less now too. I think I was given some advice at one point that says the healthiest way to do things is to pick a date and cut off at that point and not linger and linger and linger.
Yes,
And
I'm hearing you.
and I think that's what I've been doing, but I've been sucked in to do things.
Well, we all get sucked in one way or another.
But I think that's true. I avoided doing it, and then now I'm not so sure it was such a great idea, because it would have been nice to have something I could point to as sort of a summary of everything.
Well, let's think about these six papers you troubled to select. And I need your help here, because as I said, I'm not a psychologist and I'm a bit rusty because I haven't been reading these kinds of things on a regular basis, or certainly not your kinds of psychological work since 2012, right? So this is a long time. And what I might have read more easily, oh goodness, 14 years ago, is not so easy to me now. So, is it clear to you which of these six you chose to be personally satisfying? Was there one or two amongst these six, and you could say what the title was and what?
Well,
Or do you want to deal with it? You've given me a list of six which are chronological from 86, starting with your
I took
yes,
it I maybe
from
I
19.
took it a little bit differently than you had intended. I
Okay,
wanted to
you do
give you
it.
sort of an arc of my what I was working on. And
Yeah, you do that then. You talk about that because you said in your profile that you were primarily interested in describing and testing models of moral development,
Right.
right? And
Right.
then as we've already talked about, getting away from the Kohlbergian view as such, right?
Right.
Say, and then and you were talking about validity of moral models of moral functioning
Right.
and measures and components.
Right.
And then you talked about what the content was, it as it were, if I can put it that way, about
Yeah.
global ability, political orientation, educational environment,
Right, right,
and
right.
gender. And the first one you actually cited was about gender.
Yeah, that was I don't it, as you may recall, that was a topic that had sort of hit the Kohlbergian
Oh, definitely, with Carol Gilligan.
and we were I well it was two things that one is I really was curious about whether this was a real effect on the measure. Did what were we sort of setting up a system that would bias against us, another group and women or maybe even other groups. And then I was at the same time I was reading a bunch about meta-analyses, and it was just starting to take root in our field. And so I said, well, let me take check it out. And so I went through all the files of the DIT, and one of the benefits of the DIT is you have a huge database. I mean, thousands and thousands of people have taken the measure. And there's always information about those people that's retained. So I know their gender, I know their age, I know their educational level, and so on. And so I said, well, let's see if the effect is large or not. And as happened throughout my career, Larry Walker already beat me to it. And he had written in Child Development, I think, that his paper about the gender effect, and he was finding it was rather small, and that's basically what I found as well. Only in the DIT, it looked like women were actually doing better than men at each age educational level that we assessed it on, so from junior high all the way up through adulthood. And so the point that I made in the paper was, what that the age educational effect, well, let me back up, that the effect is not large in traditional ways of interpreting an effect. I mean, it accounted for less than, I think it was less than a few percentage points of the variance in DIT scores. Whereas, and you could also compare it to other known effects with the DIT. So what's the age education effect? Well, it accounts for 20, 30% of the variance. So when you compare it within, the measure, then it's small there as well. So the conclusion was it doesn't seem to be a big deal on the DIT gender, and it's pretty, small. And if you want to study something, maybe study other things. I said it in so many words. And I think Carol Gilligan reviewed the paper and she let me have it. But thankfully, it got accepted. That was actually a paper that was cited often. And so
This
I,
is your
but,
1986 paper in
yep.
Developmental Review,
Yep.
estimating gender differences in the comprehension and preference of moral issues.
Yeah. And so, and it was, it was reprinted in handbooks and stuff like that. So it was kind of fun that one of the first things that I had taken on by myself as a grad student, got through. But it was classic what I was doing and continued to do, is trying to see if I could bring techniques that had been developed in other areas to bear on issues within moral psychology. And so that gender. It's actually pretty simple, and as meta-analyses go, is probably newer models are probably more sophisticated than the ones I use. But at the time, it was sort of a new thing.
Now, you mentioned Larry Walker,
Yeah.
our friend and colleague, and
Yeah.
a similar sort of phenomenon happened to him, that he had a paper that was published in Child Development that then went on to be reprinted in various places and was influential. But Larry was, unlike you, was never directly, or in your case, indirectly, connected with the Colbergian school at the Center for Moral Education at Harvard. I'm wondering your interests seem to coincide to some extent from my perspective.
Yeah.
Oh,
Yeah, I would
I'm glad I haven't got that completely wrong because I was wondering about that.
no, and
But
in fact,
you never worked together on anything particularly, did you? But you were
no.
you so you weren't collaborators in that good sense, but neither were you particularly in conflict, I don't think, with one
Oh,
another.
no.
But you
I
sort
mean,
of ran on parallel lines.
exactly. And if he I would make a point of listening to him when he was speaking at conferences that I was at, because I always found what he was doing especially interesting, and the way in which he operationalized his variables and his designs were really exceptional. And so I always thought about his work as something that I appreciated, but it was always frustrating too, because I would be saying, "Oh, I got to do this. This is a good idea," and then I'd be halfway through and I'd see, "Oh, did you see Larry Walker's new paper?" And he just basically did the
Madly.
same thing I did. And
Brilliant.
so, like with the developmental, the other paper in my list, the one, the consolidation transition. He did something very similar, using interview-based model methods,
This is the
and
one you did with Jim Rest in 1999 in development.
yeah. I mean, it was just yeah, and it was just like, why? It's just wild how we would have similar ideas at similar times in our
You
in the field.
never thought really of getting together on this.
No, I don't think so. I liked Larry, and I talked to him as whenever I could. But he was reserved and I was sort of reserved,
Yes, this is true. You've got we both got reserved personalities. Yes.
and so it would be like, a lot of shuffling our feet and saying, "So, how's the family?" Kind of,
Yes.
and I and it wasn't really, it was never like, "Larry, let's get down and do something. We have similar ideas." And he would just sort of smile, when I would talk about what I was doing, and he would say, "Have you thought about this?" And have did you know that so and so was doing something? So he always seemed to have a better network in developmental psych than I had. And so I think he had a lot of good students that he worked with
Yes, he
that
talked about
was his
it.
it was his crowd. And for me, my crowd was mostly other faculty.
Yes, yeah.
And so I think there was no real reason for in the distance and all
It
that, but I, you know, I it would have been fun. It would have been fun.
was
I
not.
like, I like.
It was not competitive, nor was it collaborative. It was respectful, right?
Yeah, exactly. Oh,
Yeah.
I respected him tons, and as both a person, as a colleague, and as a researcher. I mean, I always found him, someone I looked up to. And I think we're about the same age, but he
Yes,
seemed to have been a.
very similar and overlapping a lot in AME. We'll come to that.
Yeah.
So your ideas were running along together at
Parallel
the same time,
lines, yeah.
right? But they weren't conflicting. And Would you like to say anything more about any of these other four papers that you've mentioned in the list to me?
Just that they were all sort of guided by the four component model, so that with the exception maybe of the context papers, the ones where people were criticizing the DIT research and the field more generally and trying to rebut some of those criticisms. So when people would say the DIT is nothing but a verbal ability measure, or it's nothing but a person a political measure, that rebutting that, you couldn't let that stand. And so, trying to respond. So that was one branch, but that was sort of an eddy, and in the other things were all sort of
So that was a paper you did in 1999 in reviewing
right, yeah.
with Darshan Vyas, Jim Rest, and Pitt
Yeah.
Derryberry, who did publish Jeremy quite a bit, I seem to remember.
Yeah. Pitt passed on, Did you know that? He
He's what?
died. He died.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He got cancer and died very quickly.
Oh, yeah.
Sad. But anyway,
So you tried to rebut some of those critiques
yes.
or malignments, really, we might say,
Yeah, really.
reductive critiques.
And there were other papers of that sort. And so I was just trying to give you a kind of an example. And to be fair, I think I picked them because they were in the best outlets.
They were all in pucker journals.
And so, but the other papers were all had to do with looking at the four component model and trying to sort of flesh out different aspects of it. And then, and that's basically what I was trying to do in different ways.
So what about mean, what will you say was a success of your investigations and your writing research papers? What do you think really hit home, was influential? You're not going to tell me that without me asking, because you're rather modest about your achievements, which are considerable.
I think if anything, it was that, well, let me back up. I think a lot of the criticisms of the Kohlberg method was Kohlberg system and its descendants, was that it wasn't really as rigorous as it should be. And I think that was unfair, frankly, but one of the things I always tried to
What
do
was
was,
unfair about it? What was
I
unfair?
think it was
The system wasn't rigorous, or the critiques?
the critiques were unfair because I
Ah.
think they were overlaying a certain research methodology on a system that was sort of governed by different sorts of rules and constraints. And so and I saw that in other areas in our field as well, that people would come in using more traditional methods and find fault. And so one of the things I tried to do was to shore up using methods and strategies from other areas to show that our field was equal to, if not better, than some of the others. And so, insofar as I was able to bring methods and measures in and avoid the easy criticisms, because it was harder to critique when you were using the same tools that they were using, that might be something.
You would say, I mean, Larry said something very similar about that, but you would say really that you were, would you say you were aiming to sort of strengthen the field, right? The understanding about what was going on, and what could be done, and what was more difficult to do and what was relatively clear and what was still a bit messy.
And ways to address them. I mean, I think I mentioned off before we recording that I was a little bit of a tinkerer, and so I wanted to show people how you could sort of engineer different ways of studying things, and in a way that would convince people from outside our field. So strengthen is your term. I think that's apt. And so yeah, I mean, that was what I was trying to do was to sort of shore things up.
Yeah. And you, we started with the gender differences. You kind of ended more looking at cultural differences.
I mean, it was part of that was through the Jubilee Center that they hired me for a 4-year
This is the University of Birmingham, England.
with
Yeah.
Christian Christensen and James Arthur and those people. And
David Walker was there, as I remember.
David was, I mean, he and I worked together from the get-go. And so the thing was, they were interested in the same sort of mission to shore up character education using best methods available to boost the field's scientific basis, I think. And so they were very keen on having strong designs, strong methods, and a good conceptual basis. And so when I was over there, I think the reason why they were interested in me is because they were interested in one of the measures that I'd put together that happened to focus on virtues. And as you know, Monica, virtues did not always have the best sort of reputation in our field. And
No.
I was, I was sort of agnostic to them as focus of a measure, but I used them because that's what character education was focused on, and my measure had a tradition of being dependent on what the instruction was. And there's a reason for it that's kind of convoluted, but the idea was you look at what the curriculum is in a profession, say. And that's the kind of ethics instruction that they are in an ethics curriculum. And that's the kind of ethical ideas and systems that they want to transmit to their students. So if you want a measure of ethical reasoning within that population, your first stop is at the curriculum. And so I did the same sort of thing in adolescent populations, and the virtues were the ones that were being instructed. And so I tried to figure out a way to use virtues in a way that would be at least understandable to someone coming out of, the moral psychology side. And so I used them as sort of concepts that people understood in different ways, and whether I could measure those different ways, and whether a measurement built on that system could make meaningful statements about adolescent development, which is what they were fit.
And
The
that was
measure I
what
developed,
that was what they were interested in Birmingham, right? Because
and they used that measure in their school project,
yeah.
and then they also, David and I worked on a measure in for military ethics, professional ethics, that used the same system, but of course a different context. And so that's what we're using. And then when that measure of moral thinking in adolescence focused on application of the virtues was created and used by other people, there were good data sets from, I think, about 5 countries: the UK, US, Macedonia, Mexico, and Taiwan. And so I thought, it might be fun at the end of my career to sort of put those together and see if I could say something about what is similar and different in how adolescents apply the virtues in these different contexts. And there were a lot of similarities, but there were some interesting differences, like the role of loyalty and friendship, and loyalty and honesty, and how they conflict, and
I'm
how
sorry,
it.
Mike, about that. What
Well, individualistic societies seem to focus more on the loyalty side. They would focus on their friends over the honesty, whereas more communitarian kinds of cultures and they tended to focus more on the honesty side, you know, in that thing that there's a broader set of considerations than the Americans in the UK.
Yeah, more socially
Yeah.
communitarian sort of consideration.
Yeah. And so it was like, you know, do you focus on your friends or to the teacher who, you know, who, or some other sort of adult,
Group,
great, yeah,
family
and
group, community or whatever.
yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there was some things like that, and that were kind of interesting. But it was, but girls were outperforming boys in all the various cultures, and then, but still, everyone had a growth pattern that was pretty similar. And so it said something about how adolescents come to understand these virtues of, you know, honesty and loyalty and you know, some of those that most people think are important to think through anyway.
Of course, that's really important. And I don't know if this question makes so much sense to you, but I feel having asked Larry it, I should ask you too.
Okay.
I mean, as a psychologist and having spent a lifetime, right, in professional life, over 40 years, thinking about these things and researching them and questioning them and trying to make sense. Do you think there is development or progress or change?
Cohort to cohort, or if within the individual?
I suppose I'm more interested, coming from a Western perspective, in the individual.
Yeah, no, I do. I do think there is development. Yeah. I think everything I've ever measured has shown clear age trends. I think, you know, but the only caveat is education. You know, when education seems to be a prime mover of development, and when education ends, the growth trajectory tends to plateau a bit. So if you look at, you know, middle-aged people with a high school degree, and you see a current high schooler, there's not that much difference. But the same age group who have gone through college do show a difference. You know, so part of that, I suppose, can be explained by interest and ability, but not all of it. And so there's something about being in environments in which you have to deal with ideas, some of which are not your own, and be in social contexts where ideas are being discussed, that promote moral judgment development, as well as social development and all the other sort of allied fields. And so, yeah, I think, you know, as long as you keep open and you're in settings that encourage that kind of openness. I feel that now sometimes when I go to, you know, it sounds sort of stupid, but senior things at the museum or something, you know, when they're talking about the life of an artist and the forces that influenced him or her, and it makes you reflect, and I think those are also things that keep you moving.
Well, that brings us back to where we started, both before we started the recording. When I was mentioning to you my current interest in ageism and lifelong moral learning,
Mm-hmm.
which of course I wouldn't have been interested in 40 years ago, but becoming an elderly person, you raise it raises questions in your mind, or your
Right.
experiences raise questions in your mind if you're still open to that. And also back to your starting point when we began this recording, about the importance of your family values on valuing education, right? And promoting an environment for your own learning in a rather free kind of way, against the prevailing norms to some extent, so it just shows really that we can, if we keep trying, or we need to try, we can keep thinking about these things, albeit in a different way, right? Before we finish, let's just give ourselves a nice, comfortable jumping off point where we met, really, on the AME Jeremy platform, right? So, really, you and I shifted in and out of this quite a bit together. We sort of did a bit of a dance. I do want to refer back to what I said earlier, when we first came across each other, the year 86, when you got the dissertation award for your PhD dissertation at AME. And I happened to have in my hand something I found when I was sorting out some AME materials, which I sent over to Kay Cook for archiving.
Oh, right, for the archiving. Yeah, I sent her some stuff as well.
And you were doing that too, I think. And we've reached that stage in our lives where we've become historians. I've got a piece of paper in my hand, which I must have seen fit to print out at some point, and it must have come out of the AME forum, though I'm remiss because, as editor, I had to be very sharp on the references. But it's obviously sometime after 2004 when you got the Kew Merker Career Award, right? And so just to recap, you started AME in about 86 for the dissertation award. You were immediately snapped up because you were a board member 87 to 91. And then you were snapped up even further and imposed upon, and you became secretary 1991 to 96. And then you neatly segued into being treasurer 1996 to 2001. You're a glutton for punishment, Steve.
I know.
And then, not
But
satisfied with all these roles, you became president 2001 to 2004. And my guess is you and I were on the board for quite a significant amount of time
Oh,
together.
yeah, absolutely.
And you were the treasurer when I became president. Guess what? After Larry Walker. So I became president 1998 in Dartmouth, New Hampshire, and I demitted, I think is the word, in Vancouver in 2001, where you took on the mantle, right?
That's right.
And in two, but we did a reverse dance. Insofar as you got the Kew Merker Career Award in 2004, ahead of me in 2006. So I want to just say something about, but I noticed that you hadn't ever given the Kew Merker Memorial Lecture, at the Colburn
Yeah.
Memorial Lecture,
Yeah.
whereas some other people who we know well have, right?
Right.
Were you ever asked?
Never.
I find that
And
really strange.
I don't know why it was. I think it was I don't know. I think there were always better choices, probably. People who
Well,
are a little bit more dynamic speakers, people who are doing more interesting things, people who had written good books.
about
Yeah,
that.
all the stuff that you mentioned before. I think I was seen as more of a sort of, well, I guess an engineer kind of guy instead of a physicist,
I think that's what you see yourself as, not necessarily how other people see you.
But anyway, but
Anyway,
that yeah, I
that
was never
is a
asked.
bit strange. After all that service, right, that you didn't get the opportunity to hold forth, as it were. Maybe we've missed that. It's our loss. But this piece of paper in my hand relates to a written interview you did with Tim Hatfield.
Oh gosh, yes, I remember that.
Right. And so I've got you having you've written certain things, but he starts off. This is when you got the Key Merker Award, and I would just like to
Yeah.
read this out. The Association for Moral Education honoured outgoing AME President Stephen J. Toma for, and it quotes, distinguished contributions to research, teaching, and service to the association and to the field of moral education. Ceremony remarks noted quotes. Sorry, ceremony remarks noted Steve's scholarly contributions to the field of moral psychology and moral education, quote, distinguished by their high levels of conceptual sophistication, empirical rigor, statistical expertise, and practical importance, end of quote. He was also cited for his exemplary integration of theory and practice, his visionary leadership for the association, and a personal example that, quotes, embodies the highest standards of moral integrity and humility, end of quote. So I think it was really worth mentioning all of that.
Well, that
Well,
was quite kind.
see, well, it's not just kind, it's true. So that should mean that you were appreciated by the Association for Moral Education. So, what, just one question about all that, because it was 30 years, long time service and involvement. Which of those roles did you like best, really? Or, where did you find you really could be useful and helpful? Because you obviously like to be like that.
Well, I think the least fun job was the presidency, I think. But it was sort of just like when I became department head in my department. I had said so much about what I thought should be done here and there, and that people would it would be hard not to say, well, never mind, I don't want to do it. You kind of made a bed for yourself, and that was what came next. And so
Yeah. Why
but I
did
think but it was fun to work with those people. I learned a lot about you and Larry, and I was working with Pat King, and
Yeah.
I learned how the system worked, what people prioritized. It was a blast. I mean, not all the time, but it was I got to know people through those mechanisms, I
Yeah.
think.
Yeah.
And
I'm glad you think you got to know how AME worked, because I don't think I ever did.
well, I knew
But you did more of the underlaboring than I did, with
yeah,
respect.
that was actually more fun, was to influence policy in very sort of, oh, I don't know, subscribe what in clear areas. So in the Treasury, there were certain things that had to be done, But also, it was a time when we became a 501c, a charitable organization, and so that was kind of fun to do and go to lawyers and deal with the federal government, and so I enjoyed all the spin-offs from that, and I didn't have to, be the figurehead, which I never really thought was a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting.
But being president, I sort of steeled myself and said, you should do it. You know what? People have asked you to do it, so they think you can do it. So
Well,
it's
I became it. I was surprised because I remember Dwight sidling up to me, and I thought, gosh, they must be desperate.
yeah, that's how I felt too.
And yet I was very honored because I was the first out of North America. I could never have done it had it not been for Larry getting all the rules, sorted out. And no doubt you had a big input in that. And as you've just mentioned, going to sort out the regulation of the finances and the setting up of the society and so on, on a proper footing.
Yeah,
So,
Larry was a big influence on me too for, getting moving up and the
yeah,
doing all
I
those
think
things.
he's very organized and administratively competent, very much so.
And Dwight too. I forgot about Dwight,
Well,
but
too,
Dwight, man.
the JME, coming on to that, you were on the editorial board for 17 years between 97 and 2014, and then I see you went in for a second term, 2017, for another 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, Christian asked me to do that, I think that's how it worked.
Yes.
And
So,
I thought it would be f yeah.
and Larry did the same. So you're in parallel again. And yes, really, gluttons for punishment. And
Well,
I saw that you listed on your CV being a referee for, I think it was about 17 different journals. That's a
I mean, that was sort of expected.
of work.
Yeah, it was a pain.
Yeah,
I,
then
you know,
what do you
but
think about that now? You think it was a pain?
well, no, I mean, it felt like a pain at the time, but it was also a window into what people were doing, and there was a lot of dross there, but there was also some really good ideas that that made me think about different things and incorporate into how I moved forward. So it was a good way to, take the pulse, and so I don't, it's easy to make fun of because it's like Friday afternoon, you got to do your reviews or whatever.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there was a really good purpose for doing it.
Well, you keep up with the field. Well, with
Yeah,
what's coming
that's it.
along, right? And you have a responsibility to do a good job on it and try and make it improve it if possible, if it needs it, and so on. Most
What
of the
hurt was when they started giving you papers that had no real connection to what you were doing,
yeah.
or so that would become more chore-like. But that was sort of the editor's issue. But if they were doing, I know this person would be a good referee for this paper, not just to get it done, but because it would give good feedback. Then I really appreciated
Well,
reading those
I
papers.
did try hard with that because I had
No, I know you
a
did.
long list of people and what they seemed to be interested in. But of course, as you get more senior, you get called upon to adjudicate on something that an editor may have already had two opinions on or something like
Oh
that.
yeah, well you and I did that on a couple of papers.
I relied
But
on that.
yeah.
But you were very solid on that. As your award citations attest, and then So I already knew you through AME and being on the editorial board, and then you became chair of the editorial board of the JME in 2006, through to 2014, 7 years. I ended my time as editor at the end of 2011.
And I think I quit right after that, right?
No. In my list that I did for the yeah, sorry, get it, we're both getting a bit tired. I did a list for 20 in 2021 for the conference we had, the 50th anniversary conference, which had to be postponed a year because of COVID. And so I went through everybody again, and you actually stopped being chair in 2014. So what you've got was two editors, right? And you've got me when I'd already been editing the journal for 30 years. I think
No,
that's
it was a different feel altogether
that.
after you and with Darsha then.
Well, I was wanting to ask you about that because, I mean, I always found you exceedingly straightforward, very supportive, and we had a business-like, respectful relationship, and I felt I could discuss with you any issues that were going along with the trust, as well as with because you were outside the trust. And I think you found that very frustrating, and that you were not always in the loop as much as you might have liked to have been.
No, it was a little awkward when I would be waiting outside while you were doing certain things, and then you would bring me in for the parts that were, I guess, germane to my position, but
Because I wasn't on the trust then, right? I was more like, I was, well, I always felt I was tremendously accountable. And that was one thing that I thought was very different after I stopped being editor.
Yeah, I think Darsha took it upon herself and her crew to sort of run things, and they would and I sort of was an outside facilitator. To make sure the meetings happened, to make sure things got done, to respond to queries, that kind of stuff. But it was much more mechanical, if I remember. In fact, as you could tell, I thought I wasn't doing it when she was in. But
Yeah, I
but
think
yeah,
she
but with you it
ran
was much more
things.
collaborative.
I think she ran things much more independently. And
Which I
in fact, there was I don't know if that was part of the deal, that I do not know. But
It was, yeah.
I noticed that for there were about 3 years after you stopped being chair of the editorial board, and Michael Rice became chair of the editorial board when there was no chair of the editorial board.
Yeah, the idea was that she would respond directly to the trust, and that they would give her sort of broad outlines of what they hope to see, and then her job was to implement them. And I know it went back with Michael, and I think given the way it works, it was probably a mistake for Helen and me to push for a different structure. I think it, for the way the history of the journal and the position of the trust, it's better this way, where there is an intermediary that is more hands-on with the editor and is also a member of the trust.
Yes, I think that's what you felt at the time when we were working together, and I was editor. You felt that you should have been on the trust, and
No, I didn't think I no, none I mean there was good reasons why I couldn't be, right? Because I was not UK and all the rest.
well, that was the supposedly legal reason.
And but they were always very welcoming. I mean, it was just clear that the position was outside of the trust, and that was fine. I didn't really chafe under that. It just seemed like it would have been more efficient at times just to have me there, and then I could, and then you could say they could take what I had to say with a grain of salt if it had nothing to do with my position or something. I don't know.
I think it was more difficult because you were US based, right? And as you've said, the trust was UK based. And I think it made, even in the days when we had email and, well, you and I used to speak on the phone, didn't we? Because it
Yeah,
was
remember that.
pre Zoom, right? And but there were means of communicating,
Well, you
which,
remember they would bring me over too for that,
and we
that.
started having meetings, trust meetings, because I was invited to join the trust in 2013 after a year's interregnum, and we started meeting as a trust once a year at AME as well as in the UK. So the structures did move a bit, but I think there was a time when things were not quite so clearly hierarchical, shall we say, or structured. You did also, I just want to acknowledge this, you also did a special issue of the JME on the DIT
That was probably the
2002.
closest to a book, really.
Yes, I wondered that, if you would think that. Yes. Of course, I say of course, but it's not always of course. You were involved with other professional associations. You're a fellow of the American Psychological Association and of AERA, and you worked with the Society for Research in Child Development. There's an awful lot of hard work here in your years, and I'm glad to say you had other awards throughout your career. You had a Fulbright,
That
Lilly
was a lot of
Fellow,
fun.
Outstanding Teaching Award, AERA, for publications on moral development. Just to come back to that, we haven't talked a lot about your teaching, but you obviously had to do a lot of teaching. What would you say you enjoyed the most, really? Because you started off with the teaching, you had to continue it. You became more and more involved in research, working with other faculty members, through the systems of the university. Through all this reviewing other professional associations and so on. But on balance, would you if you what do you think you enjoyed most, the research or the teaching?
Oh, definitely the research, but I don't really see them as being fully independent either, because teaching the undergraduate courses in my area, they kept me sort of current at the broad in a broad way, and then teaching the graduate classes, you had to keep up, and so it forced you and to keep reading outside your areas to do a credible job. And I think that's what I always tried to do, was to really represent myself as an agent of the field, and at the University of Alabama, that I am one of, I think, only one, or maybe at one point two people studying moral psychology at the University of Alabama. So if I'm teaching the moral psychology class, I'm an agent of the field, for the students who take my class. And so it was a missionary work in some ways, but also this idea that I always saw myself as representing whatever the field, like child psychology, the research and methods courses I taught, to do my best at being that sort of agent. And so it wasn't that I was all excited about new techniques for teaching or I think if anything I got across that I was interested in this area. Here's why I was interested in it, and here's what you might get out of it if if you read the papers and really got involved. And so it was so it was that I enjoyed a lot about teaching, and the fact that it did, it was, selfishly it fed into the research side as well. But I enjoyed working with the students. I think less so than if I'd been in a hotshot place like, well, I think Larry in Vancouver, I think he had good students that where that kind of being an agent was of the field would be much more fruitful, but at the same time I did see it as my job, saw it as important, and saw it as personally helpful.
Well, I think you've had a very solid influence on our career, Steve, and
Thank you.
I'm glad that that has been recognised, and you've done that over a long period of time in multifarious ways, which I hope in this conversation we've at least illustrated. Perhaps, not in as much depth about the nature of the work, but that's difficult to do in speaking. But to recognize all your many areas of service, and for being there, for being with me, very supportive, understanding, collaborative. And I'm sure that was just one of many, many examples with your colleagues and the students, and throughout all your 30 years of service to AME and a very similar number to JME, which required real thinking and knowledge, skill and insight and consideration of others. I think you're always very good at that,
Thank you.
thinking round things and how will this affect other people and so on, not being sloppy in any way. And that's worth a lot, to be,
And very
a
kind to
good
say.
human being, a good human being whom one is pleased to count as a friend. I hope we've covered enough, but is there anything you would like to say about your work and involvements that I've missed, really?
No, I think you've done a good job summarizing. So
Thank you.
thank you.
Thank you, Steve, for providing me with the wherewithal and for going back over your academic life with me. And certainly, it was always enjoyable to be relating to you, and making things happen and sorting things out. And I regard that as a great support and bulwark to my work. So, thank you.
Thanks for asking me, and thanks for the kind words.
And all the best for your future life, more with the family.
Yep, with the grandkids.
I'm
Yep.
going to stop the recording now.
Okay.